This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 387, was produced on August 3rd, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Inflation is finally coming back down, but is it about to reverse course higher again? Or are we truly in the immaculate disinflation that Juliette de Klerk described in her recent Macro Voices interview? To answer that question, Eurodollar University founder Jeff Snyder returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the inflation story over one of Jeff's infamous chart decks before moving on to consider whether the soft landing forecast that's become popular is accurate.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, August 2nd, 2023. The S&P 500 futures were down 126 basis points to 45.37. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the postgame. The U.S. dollar index up 155 basis points to 102.60, surprisingly reversing much of the July bloodbath. The September WTI crude oil contract up 90 basis points to 79.49. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. Gold down 172 basis points to 1975. The advance has stalled. Will be important to see if the bulls can defend this price action. Copper down 154 basis points to 384. Attempted to break out above that critical $4 level, but was decisively rejected. Uranium up 53 basis points to 56.40, and the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 21 basis points, closing at 408 points, broken through all resistance levels, and now sights set on that 2022 high. The key news to watch this week is Friday's jobs numbers, and next week we'll have the key CPI and PPI inflation numbers and the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment. This week's feature interview guest is Jeff Snyder. Eric, why did we invite Jeff back on the show as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, I'm convinced that we're in the early innings of a new secular inflation. I'm so convinced of that that I've reached the point that I'm starting to become dismissive of the infidels who still see the disinflation story and can't appreciate my greater vision and wisdom. Okay, that scares the crap out of me because that kind of hubris is exactly what gets us in trouble. So as soon as I start feeling like I know for sure that what's going on here is an inflation, I want to get as many disinflationists and deflationists on the show as we possibly can so that I can look out for what I might have missed in my own analysis. Jeff Snyder is no slouch. He understands money and particularly the international Eurodollar money system better than anyone that I know. And he also sees a disinflationary outcome, not the inflation that I see. So I want to understand as much as I possibly can about why he sees something very different than what I see on the horizon.
Well, Eric's interview with Jeff Snyder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Eurodollar University founder Jeff Snyder. Regular listeners already know Jeff is famous for his slide decks. New listeners, you're not going to want to miss it. So be sure to download the slide deck. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Jeff's picture that says, looking for the downloads. Jeff, before we dive into the slide deck, which is largely about inflation, I want to come back to one of our previous conversations where you told us that prices were going up and they were going to continue to go up and there was going to be no inflation. And that, of course, confused a lot of people. There's a few folks in our audience who know exactly what you're talking about. It's this distinction between consumer price inflation and monetary inflation. What's the difference? But more importantly, why should we care about anything other than the price inflation, which is what affects the, you know, how much money you got left in your wallet?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question to start with, because the last part first, consumer price inflation, as we define it, as a supply shock, which we'll get into here in a minute, versus the monetary variety, which is really legitimate inflation. They look very different. Yes, the end result is the same in the short run, but how they work out in the long run could not be different. That's what we'll talk about today, that when you have a supply shock situation, what mostly happens through historical examples is what you see is consumer prices will surge. They'll skyrocket right out of the gate and they'll go way up there, which is, you know, most people don't care. They understand they're becoming poorer by the day, but they'll surge really quickly and they'll stick around high rates of consumer price increases for, you know, quite some time. Usually it's multiple months, maybe even a couple years, but then regardless of what happens in monetary policy, the Federal Reserve or central banks, consumer prices will begin to slowly decelerate and decelerate and decelerate so that over time, and this is usually a multi-year process, all on their own, consumer prices will reach a new equilibrium. They won't go back to where they were before the supply shock, but the consumer price increases will stop so that at least we reach a different stable equilibrium as far as prices go. Whereas monetary inflation, which is real inflation, worked very differently. And that's where you get into sustained increases and sustained advances in consumer prices that go on year after year after year after year, like we saw in the 1960s and 1970s. The distinction we need to make here is that the supply shock version is not because of money printing or bank credit or anything of that kind of nature. It's instead, as the name implies, a shock to the economy that causes some imbalance between supply and demand, like we saw in 2020, where the only way to adjust and reconcile those imbalances is through prices. Whereas the other type, real genuine inflation, is from a sustained increase in either money supply or credit supply to the economy. So in the modern economy, that's the banking system, like we saw in the 1960s and 1970s. So it's a difference in where it comes from, and ultimately it's a difference in how it ends and how it gets resolved.
Well, I'm going to argue that maybe the most important thing is figuring out whether this inflation that we've clearly been having is transitory, as a lot of people, yourself included, have said. It's because of supply shocks. It's the aftermath of the pandemic. This was to be expected. It's not a new secular inflation. Then there's other people that are saying, oh, whoa, but wait, it is a new secular inflation. It is a monetary inflation. What's going to be driving this is going to be less supply of crude oil, increasing energy prices. That's going to transmit to the rest of the economy. It's going to be a whole monetary thing. Well, if you're not sure which one of those it is, because it's too early in the story to know for sure, then I guess what you want to do is you want to look at the inflation itself and say, well, how do we characterize monetary inflation that might have long-term secular impacts and we might expect it to be persistent? How do we characterize that or differentiate or distinguish it from supply shock inflation, which we expect to be transitory? Is that the idea? And if so, in this massive slide deck, do we have some slides that are going to help us distinguish between those two things?
Yeah, Eric, we're going to look at historical examples of the supply shock variety and compare them to what we're experiencing today. I mean, we're already, you know, two and a half years into it, which is more than enough time to make some reasonable, draw some reasonable conclusions here. But we knew ahead of time what this was going to be because the monetary system itself had told us from the very beginning. And we'll get into that too, where we get into what is the yield curve saying? What are bond and interest rates telling us about actual genuine monetary variety of inflation? Because if we had seen something like the 1970s, the bond curves that we've seen over the last couple of years would not have happened. So the monetary system itself, just, you know, as a way of introduction here, has been consistent from the very beginning that it was the supply shock variety, not the monetary variety.
Okay, Jeff, let's dive in then. Starting with page 3, which is the first chart in your deck here, sell me on why you think that this is a transitory after the pandemic inflation and not the beginning of another 1970s-sized secular inflation, which is what I've been thinking it might be.
Well, you look at the consumer price index. Let's start there for the United States. And what you see is that, number one, it began in 2021 with the third helicopter drop from Uncle Sam. And it happened timing-wise during a period when the global supply chain was completely snarled. COVID pandemic lockdowns, all the stuff that everybody's familiar with. So the timing there begins with the really the supply shock getting going. But more importantly is where we've been since the middle of last year. As you can see on slide 3, consumer price index, the year-over-year rate changed in the middle of last year, and it has performed this clear inflection that we see time and again in the historical supply shock cases. And I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding here. We talk about the supply shock, and as I mentioned earlier, they go roaring quick. They go really fast. Consumer prices skyrocket because of the small economic imbalances that make the supply shock a shock. But then there's this impression that especially when you use the word transitory, that the downside of the supply shock consumer price increases should happen just as fast. And that's never really the case. So let's go to slide 4 then. Look at the CPI from the 1946-47-48 supply shock case. And what you see is, again, the same kind of thing. It roars out of the gate the first several months, and then it continues to accelerate and go really painful for quite a long period of time. And it isn't until almost 2.5 years later that it starts to really, really slow down and shift. And this is where it gets important, what happens at the end of it. And I've marked here August of 1948 for a particular reason, because that's when the Anti-Inflation Act of 48 was passed, when, as you'll see on slide 5, Fed Chairman Thomas McCabe went up to Congress and said, you know, this is what we got. We've got a supply shock. He said, in the view of the pressure, the current goods, you know, continued shortages of many goods, limited capacity for increased output, all of the things that we're familiar with over the last couple years, they had that and then some in the middle 1940s. So what he was saying is exactly what you would hear from Jay Powell today. If we don't do something about these consumer price pressures, if we don't do something in August of 1948, it's going to spiral out of control, and it's going to lead us into what would have then been, or what it would have been at the time, great inflation number one. So he was saying we need to get control of the banking system. He was arguing for Congress restoring the Fed's power to raise the reserve requirement like they did in 1937 to horrific effect. And he actually got it. The Congress relented. They gave him limited authority, and they started to use it later on. But as you can see from the next slide, slide number 6, by then it was already a moot point because the supply shock had already worked its way out. And that supply shock itself, where did that come from? What was the shock in 1946? And it was the economy in the United States in particular coming off of the World War II parameters. Americans had saved up tons of savings throughout the Great Depression and certainly World War II, where you couldn't really spend much money, you know, rationing and shortages and everything else. And as the government, you know, post-war era, Americans began to spend at a time when the ability of the American system, as well as the global system, to supply that demand was just constrained. Again, it sounds very familiar to what we saw in 2020 and 2021. So you had Americans deploying this massive amount of savings, but as soon as the savings started to run out in around the middle of 1947, that's when you already saw the shift in consumer price advances. They began to decelerate, but it didn't turn into the deflationary recession that we saw in 1948 and 49 all at once. It was a slow deceleration over the next year or so, that even if the Fed had never gotten its anti-inflation authority in 1948, it wouldn't have mattered, because as you can see on page 6, by then consumer prices were already falling off dramatically, even before the Fed contemplated using its authority in the middle of 1948. The supply shock case was already reaching its conclusion, which in that particular instance was a deflationary, pretty nasty recession late in 48 and 1949. So if we go to slide 7, we'll compare a couple of historical supply shock cases, including the one I just talked about, 1946, 47, and 48. Got that plotted against the 2020, 2021, 22, 23 case, as well as the next supply shock consumer price outbreak, which was in June of 1950, really July 1950, with the start of the Korean conflict. And again, what you see, and I think you can see it really clearly on the next slide, number 8, is how these supply shocks, like I said at the beginning, they roar out of the gate, huge increases in consumer prices. And even though they're transitory doesn't mean a couple of months. It means, in all of these cases, a couple years. And you can see how closely our current case is following along with especially the 1946, 47, and 48 case, but to a certain extent, 1950 and 51, 52. But the point here is that even though each one of these was transitory, we're talking 30, 33, 34, 35, 36 months from beginning to end, which is where we're getting into right now. Compare that with the great inflation, which is on the next slide, number 9. It's very, very different. You can see it clearly. Just to be clear, the last couple of charts on page 8 and 9 are showing the consumer price index as a year-over-year rate of change. And that's what we're really seeing here. So in the early part of the great inflation in the 1960s, it starts out very differently and it ends very differently. By the time you get to year 3 and 4, inflation is still ramping up because there's this constant introduction, this constant flow of new money and new credit into the economy. Whereas in the supply shock case, especially 1946, once Americans had exhausted their savings and started to rebuild their savings, that was the end of the consumer price pressures, even though it took another couple of years to finally resolve itself into the deflationary recession of 48 and 49. And that sounds a lot like what we're seeing over the last couple of years. Now, it wasn't savings like in 1946, where Americans were not saving in the late 2010s into the early 2020s. But it was like savings altogether because of Uncle Sam's intervention in the economy with the helicopter drops and everything else. And if you look at the income statistics, what you'll see is exactly that. You see a huge increase in income from Uncle Sam's redistribution. And then into 2022, and really the second half of 2022, lack of income, lack of savings really come into it in the same way that we saw in 1947 and 48. So what we have from these three different cases is three potentially different endpoints. How does this resolve itself? The first one is the one, you know, I think that we'll see throughout the rest of the presentation here. The evidence is pointing toward a deflationary recession, very much like the 1940s. There's also the possibility it ends up like the early 1950s, where we had a relatively short supply shock. It was pretty severe, but then it went away, dissipated into a soft landing, which you hear a lot nowadays. And then the third possibility, as you raised, Eric, earlier, was great inflation 2.0, which I don't see really any evidence for that, including right here. We look at what the consumer price behavior has been over the last couple of years. There's a reason it resembles those other two and not the great inflation. And that's because we don't have the constant influx of new money and credit. In fact, in 2023, we have the opposite problem. We have a growing credit crunch, which I think contributes more to the deflationary recession, which is already developing on its own terms.
Jeff, how do we measure where we are in this story right now? In other words, we know there was a massive wave of inflation because of the pandemic and the supply chain disruptions and so forth. And then it's kind of transitioning into disinflation. Does it go all the way to deflation? You know, what happens next? How do you know where we are in the story and how do you monitor where it's going from here?
Yeah, because that's really the big question now is, okay, we see the disinflation, even the Fed says we disinflation, but what's next here? Do we continue on into the deflationary recession? Do we hit the soft landing that everybody's looking for? And so what do we look at for clues? And I would start in producer prices, because as you can see on chart 11, there's a very good correlation between especially finished goods, producer prices, and the PCE deflator, as you would expect. It's not a perfect correlation. Nothing ever is. But I mean, when you're talking about economic data, high frequency macroeconomic accounts, that's about as good a correlation as you can see. And producer prices, not just in the United States, as we'll see around the world, they're already solidly deflationary. So if we follow the producer price index in the U.S., where it's going, I mean, that's already negative. It suggests that the consumer price index, or in this case, the PCE deflator, is likely to continue to decline too. We see that in more close up on page 12. The producer price index is leading the consumer price index, or in this case, the PCE deflator, lower, really since, again, the early part of last year, and then consumer prices really turned around June. Even before the Fed got going with its rate hikes, we were already into the supply shock inflection. You look at the The overall PPI on page 13, again, you see the June inflection, more determined deflation, even though it's intermittent recently, as since November. So from November, we see more negative months than not, which has left the overall PPI just heading into deflation itself. And as I just said, this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. It's a global phenomenon. You look on page 14, even the Euro PPI, which is negative, and here I've got the Euro area core PPI, core prices. That's another thing you hear a lot about, stubborn core prices. Well, here we have producer prices in Europe that are really negative in the month of May, which I believe is the latest data we have. Already negative in April. So two straight months of declines there. And that's core producer prices, which lead the European consumer prices too. Slide 15, Japan. Guess what? Deflation in producer prices in Japan. And I think the big one is on the next slide. Page 16, China. Chinese producer prices have been a bellwether for global, not just global trade, not just global manufacturing, but the overall direction of the global economy. And we've already seen up to June, Chinese producer prices that are declining at a rate we've only seen it a couple times in its modern history. Far and away worse than 2020. We're about equal to the lows of 2015, 2016, which was a devastating time for much of the world, especially emerging markets. And we're getting into the territory exclusive company like something like 2008, 2009. So if we're looking for clues about how disinflation in consumer prices is going to resolve itself, are we going to hit the soft landing? Are we moving into deflationary recession? From the perspective of producer prices, there's not much leeway here. There's not much doubt here. Producer prices are solidly deflationary. And the reason is because economic circumstances are becoming more and more recessionary. So we've got deflation in producer prices. We've got consumer price disinflation that's moving further and further as we go. Thinking about the recent data from the PC deflator as well as in Europe, which I think we'll get into in a minute. But either way, where is all this going? The producer prices are moving the entire economy toward the deflationary recession outcome, which I think you can see pretty well on slide 17, where I've taken the Chinese PPI and measured it against U.S. wholesale sales. And once again, we see a absolutely tight correlation with producer prices in China and business-to-business sales in the United States, which suggests not just further disinflation, but also further deflation in the U.S. economy as it relates to Chinese producers who aren't producing as many goods, which is also consistent with a recessionary environment. The reason why we say Chinese producer prices are such a good bellwether for the economy is that you can correlate almost anything with a Chinese PPI. It tells you about the direction of the global economy. Here are just threw up the ISM manufacturing because we got the data for that today, which, again, another bad number for the ISM, suggesting more contraction, more disinflation, if not deflation, in producer prices, which goes along with this globally synchronized disinflationary, deflationary trend that is still developing in every bit consistent with the supply shock case.
Jeff, so far we've been talking about macroeconomic indicators. Let's go to the markets, things like a yield curve that really tells us from the market perspective what's happening.
Yeah, so we'll go to slide 19. The near-term forward spread, that's something that central bankers at least had mentioned before. When the yield curve first inverted back in March of 2022, everybody said, no, we're not going to pay any attention to that. We only pay attention to the near-term forward spread. The near-term forward spread looks at the three-month rate today and what the market believes the three-month rate will be 6 quarters ahead or 18 months ahead. And for a while there, I mean, Powell said in the early part of 2022, the near-term forward spread is steep, which is the market saying that it was expecting interest rates to be higher 6 quarters in the future than it was at that time, which made sense given the fact that Powell and the FOMC was increasingly hawkish and about to raise rates. But as you can see, really since May and into June in particular, again, consistent with what we see in the macroeconomic data, everything began to change. So that by the time we get to November, the near-term forward spread had inverted. And that's about the time you stopped hearing anybody at the Federal Reserve or anywhere talking about it. And since November, it's gotten more and more inverted, obviously took a turn lower after Silicon Valley Bank in the first stage of the banking crisis. It's come back a little bit after First Republic, But still, even today, the near-term forward spread is about where it was in February, which suggested a pretty substantial recession. What the near-term forward spread is telling us is that the market expects that interest rates, in this case, the three-month rate, will be substantially lower 18 months from now than it is today, which is consistent not with a soft landing, but instead with a deflationary recession that we continue to see in the macroeconomic data. And we go further into the yield curve mechanics, page 20. You've got the two-year cash rate, the U.S. nominal treasury, versus the two-year forward rate, which is something that the Federal Reserve comes up with doing some calculation. You can see the same thing, moderately steep around June and July last year. Then it completely collapsed, started to invert. But really, again, November and December, you see that the forward two-year rate goes below the current two-year rate, which indicative of the market suggesting rates are going to be lower 2 years ahead. At some point, you know, some point in the future, rates are going to be lower than whatever they are today, consistent with deflation and recession, certainly not continued inflation. Same thing, next page, page 21, that's just the one-year forward rate and the 12-month treasury bill. Same thing, market expecting interest rates to go lower in the future. And then, you know, page 22, you look at the yield curve over the last year and a couple months, and it really hasn't done much despite all, you know, everything that we've heard from soft landing, all the quantitative tightening that's going on, which is almost $700 billion as of the latest week in just U.S. Treasuries alone. We've got all those rate hikes in between. We've got any number of, you know, commentators saying that, you know, inflation is going to pick up again. What do they call it? Transitory disinflation. That was a term that came up earlier part of this year. And through all of that, despite everything that should be highly negative to these bonds, and not just in the U.S., but all around the world, everything that should be highly negative, highly sensitive long-term treasury bonds and government bond instruments, they really haven't done anything since last June, which is when, again, going back to our macroeconomic data, that's when everything really started to shift, when the downside of the supply shock case really started to show itself. Ever since then, the bond market has said, we don't really care what the Fed does. We don't really care about quantitative tightening. We don't really care about these soft landing narratives that come up. We're pretty sure that we've got this supply shock case nailed down. And so whether it's the U.S. Treasury curve, the German curve, and up until recently, the Japanese curve, although it's still to an extent there, the markets are saying disinflation leads to a deflationary recession.
Jeff, tell me more about this soft landing thing. It seems like we've replaced the phrase dovish pivot, which everybody was expecting imminently, even though nobody was really sure why. And now it's everybody's expecting a soft landing, even though they can't really explain why. What's really happening here? What's coming?
Well, that expectation is, you know, from the realization that the Fed's rate hikes are coming to an end, which is consistent with the disinflation that we see in all the macroeconomic data. Forget the market data. As we said, the Fed doesn't really pay attention to anything that contradicts its positions, certainly like something like the near-term forward spread that was once all the information you could want from the yield curve that nowadays they don't even mention. So as far as the Fed's concerned, we've got the Goldilocks scenario, right? We've got disinflation coming in consumer prices. Forget the deflation in producer prices. We got disinflation. It's more and more entrenched. We see it in core consumer price rates. You know, the GDP numbers for last quarter, even services prices were substantially slower than they had been previously. So from the Fed's perspective, they can say, yes, we've got this disinflation developing. So that means an end to the rate hikes. But also at the same time, we won't have a recession. It'll be terrific. We'll have no recession. We'll just have a little bit of a slowdown. Consumer pressures will go away. It's absolutely perfect, which is one reason why the stock market is seemingly on fire at the moment, because it's like the Goldilocks scenario. But, you know, is that really the case? Is that what we're really seeing in the data? Does Jay Powell even agree with Jay Powell? Because if you think back a couple years to 2019, July of 2019, Mr. Powell went up in front of Congress and told them that, you know, he was very concerned about the state of the U.S. economy. It looked really weak. The yield curve was really flattening out. Some parts of it were already inverted. The macroeconomic data was not good. And he singled out the strength of the global economy, said, you know, there's weakness around the rest of the world. We need to be really concerned here. And as I think many people might remember, within a matter of just a few weeks, the Fed was cutting rates. at the end of July 2019, they began a series of rate cuts that also included a quantitative easing in there. So we would expect if Powell back in 2019 was very concerned about recession in the economy, and today he's very constructive on the economy and consumer prices, we should be able to tell the difference in the macroeconomic data. So if the soft landing is what we see today versus what was he was afraid of a hard landing in 2019, that's not what we see in the accounts. If you go to slide 25, nominal GDP in the second quarter of 2019 is actually a little bit better than it was in the second quarter of 2023, despite the positive interpretation of the recent GDP report. Then slide 26, that's real GDP, which was actually better in 2019 than it was in the last quarter. Slide 27, price deflator. The Fed still says they're worried about consumer prices when the GDP price deflator, as you can see, is down dramatically from where it was in the middle of last year. Again, that June inflection, consistent with the supply shock. In fact, the price deflator in the second quarter of 2023 was a little bit less than in the second quarter of 2019. They're about the same there. So as far as inflation pressure or consumer price pressures, there's not a whole lot of difference already. And you can see that, I think, in the next slide, 28, the implicit price deflator for goods, just strictly goods, for the last three quarters running, that's the end of 2022 into 2023, thoroughly disinflationary consumer prices in goods, again, consistent with what we saw in 2019. But if you look at some of the other monthly indications and other non-GDP related indications here, I'm just showing you the ISM manufacturing. We're way, way, way below where we were in 2019, according to the ISM. And again, the ISM just came out today with a lot of concerning numbers, including on employment, lowest employment number for them since 2020. So we're further along in the downturn in 2023 than in 2019. That's the same on slide 30 with the ISM's non-manufacturing. Again, appreciably worse there. We'll get the update on that this week, but it's not going to look much different there. And then the unemployment rate, because the Fed always talks about the unemployment rate because their view of inflation is always derived or mostly derived from the Phillips curve. Whether there's any historical basis for that or not, they don't care. So they always talk about a tight labor market as well as a low unemployment rate as a risk to consumer prices, when the unemployment rate in June 2019 was exactly the same as it was in June 2023, I think 3.6% in both months. So in 2019, the Fed said, we're worried about the economy, we're going to start cutting rates, whereas in June, when in 2023, the Fed says, soft landing, more inflation risk. The data doesn't support that interpretation at all. In fact, when you continue to look at some of the other, you know, U.S. real GDP on a long-run basis, you can see we're way behind trends and falling further behind all the time. So the economy isn't all that great to begin with. So 2019 versus 2023, it's really just the Fed's current interpretation, which is derived from the biases of the last couple of years, than it is an their idea of a soft landing isn't really consistent with their own interpretations of these statistics from just a couple of years ago. So it's really just their bias and their reading of more often than not, that just the unemployment rate and some of the other labor market statistics than it is an overall assessment of the economic situation.
Jeff, let's broaden this out and consider some of the international drivers around the world, starting on page 33.
Yeah, I mean, again, Powell said in 2019, one of the primary reasons that he thought the Fed should start cutting rates at that time, and he even mentioned it in his testimony to Congress and throughout speeches during that time period too, was that the global economy really looked bad. And of course, he blamed trade wars and tariffs and all that stuff. But even economists back then knew that the trade wars were never enough to explain the degree and the how widespread the weakness had become at that point and how it was reverberating back on the U.S. economy. So that's a part of our deflationary recession or soft landing argument here in 2023. What does the rest of the global economy look like? Because, you know, if the Fed was worried about it 4 years ago, shouldn't we be worried about it today? Especially when you look around the rest of the global economy, and it's in much, much worse shape than it was 4 years ago. As you said, Eric, starting on page 33 with Germany, earlier this year, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, the German government put out a report that said Germany was going to avoid recession when, even at that early stage, Germany was already in recession. And I don't mean a technical recession, even though, yes, the fourth quarter GDP in the GDP in the fourth quarter of 2022 and the first quarter of 2023 turned out to be negative, which you can see on the next couple slides, 34 and 35. But more so that Germany is in a real recession. At the end of last year to the beginning of this year, the numbers they just put out this last week for the second quarter, flat GDP in the second quarter, which means that Germany's not increasing, not rebounding out of a technical recession into recovery. Instead, Germany's already in the beginning stages of a recession and is likely heading into a worse shape moving forward, which the reason we spend some time on Germany and focus on Germany is because it is another bellwether economy for the global system. And it's consistent with everything that we talked about before with, say, Chinese producer prices. Slide 35, we got German GDP there along with manufacturing, disinflation and deflation in producer prices. You can see it from Germany's perspective, where the S&P Global's PMI is just down into levels that we've only seen on a handful of occasions. It's less than 50 or less than 40, actually, which is, you know, that's 2020 or 2009. And really, that's about it. So the level of the goods economy or demand in the goods economy is consistent with ongoing deflation in producer prices and further disinflation in consumer prices. And it's not just one survey or another. If you go to slide 36, the Germany's ZEW assessment of the situation there is actually much worse than GDP. It's way down at recession levels of, consistent with 2020 as well as 2008 and 2009. So if Germany's already in recession and looking to stay in recession or maybe get worse recession, that's not a good start for the rest of the world, especially when you look at slides 37 and 38, where we have German trade, which by volume is already at lows consistent with the Great Recession 15 years ago. And I don't mean rates of contraction. I mean, actual volumes of trade is the same as when we were at the worst parts of some of the worst economic circumstances in modern history. That was already 15 years in the past. And I think this chart here and the next one on page 38 really highlights the problem that many people have is when you see the values of imports or the values of goods that have been traded around the world go high because of the supply shock, you associate that with a red hot economy. When you look at these trade statistics and a lot of other statistics, including real GDP, what you see is that the actual amount of goods that were traded, the actual amount of demand for goods as well as services was masked by that increase in consumer prices and producer prices to an extent. So we were confusing consumer price increases for a bunch of things, including genuine inflation, as well as an actual red hot economy in recovery, where when you look around the world at these trade statistics, you see that the economy never really got recovered all that much, and it has already fallen off to a substantial degree, which matters because as the nominal economy starts to roll over, we start to move out of the supply shock, increasing prices, therefore increasing revenue to a lot of these businesses around the world, they now have to normalize their own individual operations to volume that is so much less than people realized. So if you have no nominal protection from, you know, the supply shock, nominal price increases, what are you going to do? You're going to start firing workers because not only do you not have work for them to do, you also don't have the money coming in, keeping all of those things up. So as far as Germany and Europe goes, deflationary recession is more developed and more advanced than it is here, which makes sense, especially from Germany's perspective, because that's a bellwether. And so if you look on page 39, what do you see? You see the exact same thing in the German market that you see in U.S. Treasuries. Going back to last October, suddenly the German market, not only did the curve invert preceding the recession that Germany's already in, no matter what has happened in how many months since then, we're talking about almost 10 months now, rates, long-term rates in particular, have been remarkably steady, even though the ECB continues to be aggressively hawkish, right, raising short-term rates. The ECB is doing quantitative tightening since March, and none of it seems to make much difference in long-term rates. You can see the curve, how it's changed on slide 40. I talked about forward rates in U.S. Treasuries before, so on page 41, we've got forward rates in euros, Euribor futures, which look exactly like the German curve and the U.S. Treasury curve, which is inverted since last year, really last fall. The fireworks in September and October, they actually did produce a huge shift in the marketplace, which is consistent with rates going down in the future, which is itself consistent with the deflationary recession scenario. And so it just continues to go data point after data point. On page 42, going back into macroeconomic data, we see the consumer prices in Europe measured against consumer price expectations from the European Commission's economic sentiment indicator, pointing for more disinflation at the very least ahead. Producer prices, consumer prices, you know, I talk about the relationship there. It's not just in the United States. We also see the same relationship in Europe. Very close correlation between producer prices and consumer prices. And producer prices in Europe, as I mentioned, they're already deflationary. So likely more, at least disinflation in consumer prices in Europe. European GDP, which just came out yesterday. Again, you see Europe never really recovered all that much in real terms and now experiencing a recession that is not likely to get out of. More forward-looking indications for the second half, more negative than they were in the first half. And so Europe, Germany, you look at those and it's a picture of where the U.S. is going to be in a few months. The recession in Europe is already more developed, even if consumer prices are lagging, which is not unusual, as we've said before. Producer prices and deflation, the economy overall heading for much worse trouble. And one reason why, slide 46, again, this is a globally synchronized problem. And the biggest problem is probably China. Slide 47, the Chinese GDP is just a mess. And the last GDP number around 6% is actually much worse than it appears. That just had a high base effect comparable to the second quarter of 2022 when China was locked down to a high extent. You also see just horrible retail sales numbers in China. The last one for June was 3%, I believe. There was a time when anything less than 7 or 8% was considered a recession. Now we're lucky. China's lucky if they get 3%. And that's with an easy comparison. Slide 49, fixed asset investment. And you just keep going through all of these economic statistics from China. What you see is exactly what we started out with. You go to slide 50 and 51, trade numbers. Trade recession, we're already in the same territory as 2020 or 2016 or 2008, 2009, whether it's imports or exports from China on page 51. We got one of the worst export numbers in Chinese economic history for June. So it's when you step back and look at everything, you've got disinflation in consumer prices, but that's looking behind us to an extent, and it's already consistent with the supply shock case. Looking ahead at what producers and markets are saying, producers are already cutting prices to try to deal with the lack of demand. At the same time, markets are pricing forward from that lack of demand, as well as deflation in producer prices and disinflation in consumer prices, saying this is only going to continue, especially as it spreads everywhere around the world. Now, I focus here on Germany, Europe, and China, as well as the U.S. You can look at other places around the world that are in similar circumstances because it really is a globally synchronized trend. And to me, that globally synchronized trend, all of the data points toward not a soft landing, not a great inflation 2.0, but the 1946, 47, 48 case, which, you know, go back to slide 53, again, China producer prices, highly deflationary, which will spread across the global system.
Jeff, as always, I love your charts and graphs, but I'd like to try to tie all of this together now, because if I look at your whole presentation about soft landing and everything else, it seems to echo a lot of what I've heard from some of our expert Macro Voices guests in the last several months. So many different voices kind of saying, look, it's not over till it's over. The bear market bottom is not in. This is a bear market rally. You know, we've heard all of these different messages basically saying it ain't over yet. There's a bad ending here. It's still coming. But look at the stock market, Jeff. I mean, we're way past the 61.8% Fib retracement. I mean, what are we waiting for to see a reversal at the 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent point at 47.96 point something? So that we don't quite get an all-time high before the bear market rally is over? I mean, it doesn't look like a bear market rally. It looks like we're headed to new all-time highs and everything's better. But I think you and I agree that everything's not really better. Why does the market think it is?
Well, I think the market loves what the soft landing scenario presents. And right now, when you look at the macroeconomic data, there's enough ambiguity in the statistics where you can say that, yes, this is nothing more than a soft landing. We're in an economic slowdown globally, but the slowdown will slow down. It'll stop before we get to recession. Jay Powell is going to stop hiking rates. It's going to be the absolute perfect recovery scenario. And so if you're a stock investor and you believe in the soft landing stuff, then wouldn't you want to buy now before it actually gets confirmed? And so the question is whether or not the market is sending us a useful fundamental signal of the future possibilities, which I don't believe stocks really do.
Or the biggest bull trap you've ever seen, which is what it's sounding like to me.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Eric. I absolutely believe that's the case. And I think, you know, after you think about it this way, when did stocks hit their high? That was late 2021. And so for the last year and a half, everybody's been sitting back saying, oh, this sucks. I need to get back in the market. I want to get back in the market. I need to get back in the market. And as soon as the Fed says, we're going to stop hiking rates and it looks like a soft landing, everybody got back in the market. Why are we so surprised about that? And to me, again, equity prices don't really have a whole lot of fundamental signals involved with them. And it's really a reflection of what people are thinking and therefore trading on. And if people are buying the soft landing story, then the stock market will be literally buying the soft landing narrative, which is exactly what I think is happening here. And I think it all falls apart the moment we get a negative payroll print or the unemployment rate jumps above 4% and continues to rise. I think the employment numbers, which is what everybody bases their narrative on, once they turn, that's going to be the, uh-oh, this is a trap moment.
So you think that because that's really the important confirmation or catalyst for the next leg. You think the thing to watch for is a soft print in employment data specifically, or what exact print should people be watching for to say, okay, here it comes?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the macroeconomic weakness we've seen so far hasn't really made a dent. You know, like I said, I mentioned the ISM, other PMI data that's just really ugly. Overseas economic accounts that are really ugly. Stocks don't care about any of those things. I think like the Federal Reserve, equity investors or a lot of people who are buying stocks have really focused in and have tunnel vision on the employment data. Because what did Janet Yellen say? As long as the unemployment rate is low, we won't have a recession. And I think a lot of people believe that, which is the wrong thing to believe. The lowest unemployment rate in U.S. history was hit the month before a recession began. The unemployment rate doesn't really tell us anything about future cyclical conditions, but I think a lot of people have bought into it because the last couple of years have been pretty bad for stock investors. And the idea of a soft landing without rate hikes, no recession, it's tremendously alluring up until that unemployment rate number changes or the payroll report becomes negative or something that pierces the fantasy that we're going into a soft landing because the labor market appears to be so strong.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about eurodollar.university, which is the new URL for something you and I started a few years ago.
Yeah, you know all about Eurodollar University, Eric. It's been a long time. I can't believe it's been 6 years already. Yes, we started out Eurodollar University back in 2017 to really try to explain what the monetary system is, how it works, and why it matters. And then over the years, I've developed it into a much more detailed process, a much more detailed output, where you can go to eurodollar.university, sign up for memberships and research subscriptions and all that stuff to really explore the global reserve currency, how it's supposed to work, why it isn't working, and what the implications are for the global economy, for investing, and for everything that really matters on a day-to-day basis.
Now, I'm embarrassed not to know this answer myself, Jeff, but we still have the original recordings of you and I 6 years ago doing Eurodollar University. Those are at macrovoices.com/EDU for Eurodollar University. Is that still relevant, or is there a more current and updated version of that they can find at eurodollar.university?
It's much more organized, detailed, as well as exhaustive. There's about 50 hours of material at the Eurodollar University website in the members section where we tear apart all of the fundamentals of money. Why do we pay attention to curves? What is it that really goes on? What's the importance of collateral? All the specific details of the monetary system. I've taken our Eurodollar University from Macro Voices and just expanded all over the place with it.
Well, I'll get our webmaster to redirect the EDU page over to eurodollar.university, and we'll get you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Kalarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jeff back on the show. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Larnick. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Jeff's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a record 17 million barrel drawdown. As far as I know, that's an all-time record, but remember the records all-time, you know, it only goes back to the 1980s or so that we've been keeping these records. I'm still pretty sure in the history of the world, there's never been a 17 million barrel drawdown in a single week from U.S. oil storage ever before. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has given up on refilling the SPR, scapegoating OPEC and changing market conditions, saying they're going to wait for lower prices that are probably not coming. So I don't think we're going to see the SPR refilled. Hey, I think I heard a podcast someplace where they predicted that. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.2 million barrels. Gasoline, building, not drawing down, but building 1.5 million barrels. That was the surprise on the board. Distillates drawing down 796,000 barrels. U.S. production holding unchanged at 12.2 million barrels. Tape action, well, there was a huge, huge rally because the API had anticipated the inventory. It's a great big rally right up to the release of inventory. And as much as this was an all-time record high drawdown and therefore a bullish print, it was that surprise loss of demand in gasoline that really kind of surprised the market. And I think there was also a certain amount of buy the rumor, sell the news effect here. So it was right after inventory came out that the market collapsed by several dollars. But again, I think this is a case of the market just buying the rumor and selling the news. As far as where we stand in the bigger picture, these breakouts above the 100 and 200-day moving average, which are now sustained, definitely spells at least what looks to me like the beginnings of a new bull trend. And that certainly is in line with what Dr. Anas Al-Haji predicted, although he thought it would come later in the year into Q4 or maybe into Q1. Perhaps we're seeing early signs of that. I still don't discount the possibility of that blow-off top in the stock market that Darius Dale predicted. If that were to happen, it could result in a reversal of everything and we could still see new lows on oil. But unless we get that dramatic reversal where there's a stock market crash or something of that magnitude, it looks to me like we finally have the beginnings of a sustainable rally in crude oil. I'd love to see a retest of the 200-day moving average on the continuation chart. That's right around $77 on WTI. If we were to retest that now as a support level rather than as a resistance level, and then rally back off of that, back above $82, which so far has been the high in this move, those would be the signals that would tell you that we really have maybe the beginnings of a new structural bull market. It's still early to say, but I think things are beginning to look pretty good.
Yeah, Eric, I put that 200-day moving average on the chart on page 2, and I find that this is such an important moment. First of all, oil was so bearish going into June, and it really was trading along its all-time lows, just really asking the question, could we see a breakdown to 60 or 55 or something lower on the downside? And this rally throughout July just had so much bullish progress in the fact that it completely wiped out the sell-off that was occurring into the start of May. And now that we are above the 200-day moving average, this is the first sustained period above the 200-day moving average in a year. You have to go back to the first three quarters of 2022 to see a period where we were above that 200-day moving average. So we've had this one-year oil bear market. And what's going to be really interesting to see is that now that we've seen this pullback over the last 24 hours, it's going to be really interesting to see whether the bulls buy the dips and whether they can maintain that price action north of that 200-day moving average. If we see generally a bullish behavior of dips being bought and price action being well defended, then we could see this as a base during this consolidation that allows oil to go and retest some of those third quarter highs from 2022 where it was trading near $90. And nonetheless, We're in the midst of some sort of a little correction, and now it's going to be about seeing what happens next. Let's move on to equities. What are you thinking here, Eric?
Well, 46.12, which I mentioned last week as a technical level that was holding the market, has continued to hold. Now we're seeing the market, at least on Wednesday, starting to trade off significantly. If all the experts who said that this is just a bear market rally and the worst is yet to come are still going to be proven right, that needs to happen pretty darn soon. Remember, Darius Dale was one of those bears who was saying that the downside is still to come, but he also predicted that right tail risk was what was going to happen first. So far, it seems to be playing out the way Darius predicted. Are the bears really going to be proven right in the end? Well, it's still early to say.
Yeah, I want to talk about that 46.12 high in just a moment, but let's get Nick involved in this conversation. Nick, obviously a big reversal here the other day on the S&P. The volatility has expanded. How do the support resistance levels look on the S&P based on the options market?
So the spot price right now is approximately 45.15 on SPX. There's a call wall above at 46.50 and a put wall pretty much right where we are right now at 4,500. The implied move for the August 18th OPEX, which is about 2 weeks away, is plus or minus 100 points. So the upper expected move is about 46.15, just below that call wall, and the lower expected move is 44.15. Key resistance is at 4,600 above. Key support below is at 4,500, 4,350, then 4,300. Now, my thinking here is that if we do break below that 4,500 mark and stay below it on close, we likely see a fast flush down to that 4,400 area. That might coincide with Apple's earnings tonight if they have a weak report, which should sell the market off into tomorrow.
Interesting you say that the Apple earnings, because Apple and Amazon are going to be obviously the things to watch going in from an earnings season. And it's really almost the end of the earnings season, which really has not seen anything really bullish about it. But what I find interesting is this correction, if I go on page 4 on the S&P, started with a direct test into the highs from the third quarter of 2022, right around that 46.12 level Eric was talking about. What's interesting is that we had this upwards channel that was the decisive bull trend higher that that really got us up here, but we now have definitively broken that channel. Now, typically, and very similar to the market correction that we saw in June going into early July, was this kind of 100 point drop over 4 or 5 days. And it got bought on dip pretty quickly. And right now, this pullback actually has many of the same characteristics. It's a 3-day sell-off now that's just over 100 S&P points, coming right into some very important Fibonacci zones right around this 4,500 level. This is a moment where we're going to find out whether the character of the market has changed or the personality has changed, because up until now, when we get these types of pullbacks over the last 2 months, they almost immediately get bought on dip. So will we see actually a positive reaction maybe to Apple and Amazon that maybe has this bought on dip and sends it right back to 4,600? If we see that the bulls don't show up and this becomes a deeper correction, then that 50-day moving average, which lies around 4,440, is going to be the magnet. And so that 4,400 level just down below is going to be a place where we could see some testing. But if this was a correction very similar to the December and or February market corrections, which ended up being 300-plus point pullbacks, then even a pullback as deep as 4,300 could happen. With all of that said, there is still nothing bearish about these charts. They are still in very clearly in bull trend. And this is a correction that was typically expected once you have an advance as fast and as far as we've already gone. What will really be the valuable information throughout the month of August is going to be the way that dips are being bought and whether or not the bulls are able to re-achieve or regain some of these previous highs. If we see that this market becomes very distributive, larger increases in implied vols. We'll talk about that on the VIX chart in a moment. if we see that it becomes very distributive, then I'm going to get far more bearish off of these levels. But certainly, we now have established a key swing high that that is going to be something we're going to be discussing in the weeks to come. With that said, let's just quickly touch on those NASDAQ levels. Obviously, the NASDAQ is going to be an important factor here because of the Apple and Amazon earnings coming out here after we recorded this. And so what levels are you watching here, Nick?
So the spot price on NASDAQ right now is 375 approximately. We have a call wall above at 385 and a put wall just below at 370. The implied move for the August 18th OPEX is plus minus 12 points. So the upper expected move would be 387 and the lower expected move would be 363 approximately. Now we have resistance just above at 400 and then at 409, which are the all-time highs, and key support just below at 370. Again, as I said in the past weeks, I do think that tech is very overextended and the multiples on PE are very, very high right now relative to historical averages. And I favor the small caps in terms of the Russell over the NASDAQ. So I'm not inclined to really buy any of these dips unless we see a substantial sell-off in the realm of 5 to 10%. And I do think we see some more downside before we see a touch of the upside. Again, it's possible we push all-time highs if we get a good report from Apple or Amazon or both. But I'm inclined to think we see more downside first.
All right. Well, let's talk about the volatility levels, because obviously we saw multi-year lows on the VIX, as we saw even the 12 handle at one point on a couple intraday basis, but really a consolidation along the 13 level on the VIX. And everything was pretty complacent, but the last 2 days of selling have now us in the 16 and a half levels on the VIX, and certainly a return back to some of the levels we saw in the first half of the year. Do you think this is a meaningful turn up, or you think this is just a short-term blip because of the selling?
It could be a short-term blip for sure. I mean, looking at the current spot VIX, which is about 16 or so, which denotes 1% daily moves in broad markets. I mean, I touched on it last week and the week before that these low levels on VIX, we have these events that come out of left field, catalyst events, that is. So this week, for example, was the Fitch downgrade of US, which caused a spike in the VIX and also a correlating decline in broad markets. Also looking at, you know, things like the US dollar, for example, which I'll touch on in a sec, that's rallied back up as well a little bit. So there's a confluence of events right now that are pointing to a bit of risk off, perhaps, as we get into the late summer. But right now, again, premiums are getting a bit more elevated, which is kind of nice if you're selling premium, which I am myself. You got to be cautious here, I would say. Now, moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index, which I just mentioned. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
I said last week that we're right on the edge of retesting a prior support level as resistance, and I expected that resistance to hold. I thought the market would fail there and the dollar would move substantially lower. That was proven wrong this week, at least my prediction as to where it was going to go. Remember, technical analysis doesn't predict future prices. It only predicts where the forks in the road are likely to occur. And I think we correctly predicted that's where the fork in the road was going to be. I thought it was going to take the other fork. What all this means is now we have a new signal, which is a false breakdown reversing above the prior support level to reestablish the prior consolidation range. The next big tell is whether the dollar can rally above 103.75, which would signal a trend reversal to the upside. But what I find just astonishing is that the market has almost completely, totally ignored a major rating agency downgrading the credit rating of the United States of America, which no longer enjoys a AAA Fitch score as of this week. I'm reminded of Stan Druckenmiller's words of disbelief when everyone was focused on the debt ceiling extension rather than the much more pressing question of the unsustainable debt problem that we've been ignoring for decades. Prominent members of the finance community are actually ridiculing Fitch this week, while nobody seems to care that interest rates went back up just as the doomers predicted, and that compromised U.S. sovereign creditworthiness just as the doomers predicted. Don't worry, though, about the credit downgrade, folks. There's nothing to see here. Just bring on the MMT and let's spend, baby, spend until we lose that AA rating, too. And when we do, we'll just say it's only silly politics and it's not real. I think that we should take this stuff seriously. And it's really telling to me that the market has completely ignored such an important signal.
You know, what's interesting, Eric, is that that dollar rally has now almost completely wiped out that July bloodbath that we had at the start, where the dollar index broke down to year lows. And at minimum, this really asked the question as to whether or not that was a legit breakdown, or whether just it was a short-term liquidity event, and that we're really returning back into that trade range that's been dominating the dollar all year long. The one thing which I typically like to technically see is dips being bought. So now that we've seen this very robust rally, will we see that the areas where all these lows in February and April and May, which all occurred around this 101 level, will all short-term little pullbacks on the dollar stay north of 101? If we see that the price action remains in the trade range that was established all year, then it may end up proving that the dollar breakdown wasn't really a breakdown at all, and that the trade range is the prevailing force.
And moving on to page 8, we have the chart of the gold futures. What are you thinking here, Eric?
Well, you'd think that if gold's major competition is the U.S. Treasury market, and that got a credit downgrade this week, well, that ought to have caused any rational investor to say, hey, gold's a better deal than Treasuries because it didn't just get downgraded by a major rating agency. And by the way, it can't get downgraded because it doesn't have any contingent liabilities. But there's no luck there this week. As I've said before, I think the Fed policy is going to prove more hawkish than most participants expect. That, not the fundamental factor of U.S. Treasuries being downgraded, is what's going to present a headwind for gold. I'm still hoping for a dip to 1860 or lower so that I can add to my long position. Longer term, though, I couldn't be more bullish.
And what's interesting to me is that the bull scenario that I had for gold and silver really were anchored, obviously, on two factors. One is this pullback in rates, and two, in the U.S. dollar continuing to weaken, and simply neither of the two have manifested. We continue to see higher yields and the dollar strengthening. If this was a false breakdown in the dollar, and it just may mean that gold is likely to continue to be trade range bound. While I do think that there's a bull cycle coming in gold, question is, does it come when the next easing cycle starts, which could be many, many, many months away? So right now, with gold failing at this 50-day moving average, which I have on the chart, the bigger question is, will we see a break of those June-July lows? If it does, a consolidation over the span of the third quarter, where gold can retest February, March lows as it remains muddled in a period where we might see a little bit more risk off in the broader markets, may be what comes around. Obviously, let's watch what happens in the dollar, and I think it'll tell a lot about what's happening in gold. I want to move on, though. On page 9, I have a chart on copper. And what's interesting is that we had a very definitive breakout attempt above $4 on copper, which was decisively rejected. And while the ascending trend line, which I've drawn on here, has not been broken to suggest that copper is bearish, it certainly was a false breakout. And one of the things to watch on copper is whether this trend line does get broken, and whether or not copper is destined to somehow go and retest the lows from May and June. I, at this moment, was giving the bulls the benefit of the doubt, but they really have to show up here and push this right back toward those highs in the coming week, because any further weakness here is just going to mean that copper has to wait a little bit longer in that cycle. Finally, though, I wanted to, on page 10, just touch on that, just the market breadth. And this is using the New York Stock Exchange, the percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving averages. And really what it does is it just really shows how the market cycles through periods of large distribution to broad rallies. And we've gone from back during the regional bank crisis, where over 80% of stocks were decisively being distributed in a downtrend, to now the reverse, where we had a very strong uptrend where 80-85% of stocks were very bullish. And this cycle tends to very well demonstrate the kind of expansion and contraction cycles. So now that we've been this overbought, we're obviously due for a pause, and it really is interesting to see that it is reversed here. And the question now now is this a swing high in the markets? Obviously, we talked about the S&P already. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming days.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
On this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as Jeff's slide deck and the charts we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.